$20 for the U.S. and Canada.
Any of the albums that I make? There are a couple of writers from the New Musical Express in England. Would you like me to try and get you a copy of this?
Would it
be of any kind of possible use background? I mean, it's...
Yes.
Again, I don't agree with all of it, but of the books that I've seen on my work...
Terrific. If I can get a copy. Do you know what I'm doing? Do you know why I'm bothering
yes,
you with
I
this?
Do. Yeah.
And I have now done 225 interviews. This book is coming out in November.
And you run a record company.
It's killing me. It's killing me. Because James Brown will say, "Hey, man, you know I love you. Why don't you come to Augusta?" I said, "That's 2 days.
Yeah.
I got to take out of work to go down. Can't you do it on the phone? Can't we do something?" I've just started doing something on the phone. I did Phil Collins and Robert Plant last week on the
phone.
How
did you do with Brown?
Oh, with James Brown?
Yeah.
I finally did him on the phone.
Extraordinary
and he was crazy.
Guy.
Oh, man's crazy.
Extraordinary.
The man is out of his mind.
Absolutely.
Well, Jerry Lee Lewis is out of his mind.
He's
Little Richard. I have talked with some lunatics in the spirit. I started with big bands with Artie Shaw, who probably is still talking, David.
How wonderful.
The man... Have you ever? You've probably never met him.
I know the music pretty good.
But my God, you turn on the tape recorder and he starts, and that's it. And he is so bright. The man reads 2 or 3 books a week.
Yeah.
He has opinions on everything.
Yeah.
And a strange thing happened. I interviewed Ray Charles, and I mentioned the Artie Shaw to Ray Charles, and he started to jump around. Artie Shaw was his hero, was his
good,
absolute
good.
Idol. He says the man had ethics and he could play the. So I said, "Have you ever met him?" He said, "No." So I called Artie Shaw.
And put the two together.
I set up a lunch.
After all this time.
The two of them together, and they were like two asking for autographs, asking for albums to be autographed and things
isn't
like that.
Isn't that
and it has been, I think this book can be a big winner, but if it's not, I have had an extraordinary experience in talking
to
B.B. King or Frankie Lane or Bo Diddley or Paul McCartney or George Michaels or Aretha Franklin or Herbie Hancock and Stan Getz and... Oh, there's 200 and some odd, and it's been edited, and the Warner Books will have it, and it'll be ready for November this year, and I'm thrilled I got a chance to spend a little time with you.
Oh, I'm so happy.
I have, in doing research for all of these people, there's some like Bob Dylan and the Beatles, there's obviously tomes of material. I have never read such psychoanalytical background of an artist as I've read about David Bowie.
Mm.
How do you feel about that? Do you believe any of this stuff?
This sounds incredibly... I'm not sure if it sounds elitist or naive on my part, but I frankly have never read anything that has been put out in book form on me other than the couple of record books that have come out. But in terms of people analysing me, I think that would... just get in my own conception, get in the way of my own conception of what I do and what I want to do.
You are aware that there is this psychobabble that goes on. I read this last night. I mean, here's 23 pages I've never read things like this about somebody. Usually it's about the career.
Well, I'm quite sure I remember seeing stuff on Dylan that was much the same.
I guess so.
There was an English period on the Beatles when Tony Palmer first decided that they were art in the Times. I think that produced that really sort of started the whole ball rolling for home philosophers and psychoanalysis on artists.
When it was happening, during those 70s, were you conscious of it then, there, about how people were perceiving you?
Yes, it was all far too... it was all far too ridiculous, I thought. It really is. I'm just a popular musician.
And you view yourself that way.
Yeah, very much so. Completely so.
Why, before you came along and did it, the popular music stars had not projected other personas. What inspired you to do it, to take on...
It wasn't... I don't think it was... it was fairly much of... Up until... there were a body of us, I think, in England at the time that were working toward... maybe separately from each other, but working toward the idea of giving another dimension to rock. I mean, we all enjoyed rock, and most of us were at art school, I suppose. There were Roxy Music, T-Rex, Mark Bolan. Who else, I guess? I guess, and in America, there was Iggy Pop, who, of course, is also radically different to the person that he projects on stage. But up until that time, I think it was what you see is what you get. And it just seemed to be interesting at that time to try and devise something that would have, at any other period, have been put into just the musical tradition, like a musical, where the artist on stage was in fact playing a part. It just seemed to be an interesting way to go.
Well, while you were doing that in England, I had signed an act in the States, Alice Cooper. That
yes.
Were you conscious of Alice and what they were doing, or it happened about the same time?
Yeah, from a periphery kind of way. I liked him very much. I got to meet him pretty early on, and I really liked the guy. I thought he was a really nice guy. In fact, a lot of those guys I liked. I liked Johansson from the New York Dolls,
yes,
who was also a pretty hip guy around that period. And I found him terribly amusing, anecdotal, and just kind of a joy to be with. And I found the same with Vince as well.
And here is Johansson out with another.
Yeah, we kind of all knew each other, I think, or at least of each other.
Yes.
I actually didn't see Alice until well into the period, probably around 75, 76. I was so single-minded about doing what I wanted to do that I actually probably see more bands and more artists these days than I did in those days.
What was the reaction of your audience, of that audience, mm. It wasn't your audience at the moment, mm. when you came and you did theatre on stage?
Well, I guess in England it's very easy to build up a cult following. We started off in playing small clubs in and around London. We developed very quickly a very sizable cult, and they would travel. Until we came to America, I think that's the first time we played to audiences who weren't sort of our audiences. And then it was just a question of letting them know that the music was quite as good as the theatrics, and we actually had an easy ride. We didn't have many problems of anybody really being anti what we did once they came to the shows. As in all cases, if the thing's worth doing on stage, I think if you can cut it on stage, I think the audience is with you.
There are two aspects of the music. One,
we had very small audiences in America.
That's right. Remember,
let me add that.
They were not.
Meadowlands. Though De Vries tried very hard to magic up a huge following for us. We were, in fact, playing to maybe in a 10,000 seat or 800 people. I mean, it was quite disparate.
Was that discouraging for you?
I'm sorry?
Was that discouraging for you?
I think, no, we were so excited by what we did. I think we thought that we saw the whole thing as a kind of a helter-skelter kind of ride anyway. I mean, it was just such fun. The whole period was loony.
Somebody, I read a quote, somebody called you a surreal cartoon character brought to life.
It was sort of, yeah. Ziggy was. I mean, he was half out of sci-fi rock and half out of the Japanese theatre. I think those are the two major elements that I put into him. The clothes were, that time, simply outrageous and simply nobody had seen anything like them before. They were the brainchild of a now very well-known designer called Kansai Yamamoto, who was just sort of beginning then, and I fortunately had seen a lot of his stuff and thought he was probably the most extraordinary designer at the time. And we got together and he did all the early Ziggy clothes. So, and he knew what I wanted out of Japanese theatre as well, so he kind of contemporized a lot of the Japanese kind of kabuki and no theatre look and made it work for rock and roll.
David, there was nothing that I had ever read in your background and growing up that would have indicated that you would have taken this extraordinary interest in so many other dimensions of the arts, as you say.
Yeah, not really.
Was it self-taught? Or?
I guess more than anything else, yeah. I mean, it was just a very reserved, quite respectable childhood. Nothing ever really happened to me that one would consider freaky. I mean, it was just a south of London school. I guess the only thing which might have spurred my interest on a bit more was the fact that I went to one of the first art-oriented high schools in England, the equivalent of a high school, where one could take an art course from the age of about 12, 13, as opposed to waiting till 17 when you go to art school. So there was a strong bias toward art from when I was quite young. And I had a very excellent teacher, Peter Frampton's father.
Oh, that's right.
Who really kind of was quite an inspiration to all of us who were involved with him, because it was an experiment for him to try and get kids involved in art at a younger age than they would otherwise. And so I think about and must have been a good three quarters of our class went on to art school, which is a hell of a proportion. And some of us went straight into street jobs because we didn't really believe in ourselves as painters or artists. And I was one of those. I went into the visual side of an advertising agency, and I was doing paste-up jobs and small designs for raincoats and things like that. Awful. Absolutely awful.
Maybe you should have kept it, too. You'd have owned four
shots. Well, if all this goes down the tubes...
You can always go.
I can get on Madison Ave there with the best of them. I think those days are over. But it did give me an unbridled interest in art, and I think if one is acquisitive inquisitive in knowledge and have a natural thirst for it, it goes through your entire life. I mean, I never stopped having an interest in what painters are doing or what writers are writing, and I'm an avid reader, and I go to the theatre a lot. I just get out and about and see the people who are trying to reproduce the fabric of our society and how they do it, and it's just an unbridled passion that I have for it. I love it. I collect a little.
Back to the theater on stage.
Yeah.
Was there a point where people didn't take your music seriously because you were theatrics?
I'm not really sure about that. I don't think it ever. I think I moved out of Ziggy fast enough so as not to be caught by that one. I noticed it did happen with Alice,
yes.
In a bad way.
Absolutely.
And possibly it's because most rock characters that one can create only have a short lifespan. I don't think that they're overly durable album after album. I think it's... I think they are one-shots. They are cartoony, if you're going to get involved in that kind of thing. And the Ziggy thing was worth about one or two albums before I couldn't really write anything else around him or the world that I'd sort of wanted to put together for him. So after Aladdin's Sane, which was the sort of follow-up to that, I had to start thinking quickly about what I wanted to write about next, which came out as an abortive attempt at 1984. Abortive because we couldn't get the rights from Mrs. O.
Oh,
yeah, because she saw his work through a far more serious pair of eyes than I imagined. We did. I got half the thing written and like a very naive again. And before I thought, I better go and ask her if I can continue doing this, you know. And then I got the big N-O. So, oh no, what do I do now? So I sort of did a quick turnaround, and it became Diamond Dogs, which was sort of a piecemeal attempt at forming a sort of a post-nuclear kind of society, with that sort of rather shabbily disguised, anyway, form of 1984.
Did the trying to achieve some kind of theme running through, or some kind of character, did that distract you from the music itself, or were you able to just go straight ahead with music?
Actually, funnily enough, I've always found it easier to write for other people than for me.
Yeah.
I feel terribly inhibited about writing for me, because it's only the last few years that I've actually resigned myself, and it is a resignation that I am a moderately good singer. I'm not a great singer, but I can interpret a song, which I don't think is quite the same as singing it. So I was never unaware of my strength as an interpretive performer, but writing a song for me always rang true. I had no problem writing something for Iggy Pop, or working with Lou Reed, or writing for Mott the Hoople. If anybody wants a song, come and ask me, and I can do it in 15 minutes, and I have a great time doing it. I can get into their mood and what they want to do, but I find it extremely hard to write for me. So I found it quite easy to write for the artist that I would create. I guess that must have gone hand in hand with the reason why I wanted to do it like that in the first place, because I did find it much easier, having created the Ziggy, to then write for him. You see, even though it's me doing it, I was able to sort of distance myself from the whole... Yeah, it can become very complicated.
There is a psychological... Yes, it is.
Yeah, fucking with the fabric of time. It did bring its a whole sackful of its own inherent problems, but some of them weren't as funny as the rest of it. But it certainly was easier writing for a character. Until recently, and it seems as I've got older that I find it easier to write purely and simply for my own satisfaction. One thing I've never written for is an audience. I've found that the occasional couple of times I've actually tried to write for an audience, I've never felt comfortable with it, and I felt that artistically it's always been somewhat short of what it should have been. So I do feel that an artist can only write for himself and his own personal satisfaction, and if he still has an audience at the end of it, that's wonderful. But it's foolish to just try and be popular. I think it's short-lived satisfaction. The fulfillment is not great.
There was at one point you really wanted to make some revolutionary kind of record, wasn't it, with Visconti or...
Yeah, I think, well...
That happened later on.
Can jump onto that quite easily. There was, from the Diamond Dog abortive 1984 thing, which did produce one excellent tour, I put every possible thing I'd ever wanted to see on a stage in rock and roll on the stage with that tour, the Diamond Dogs tour.
They recorded a live album too, didn't they?
Yes. Needless to say, it's a huge financial disaster, but it was... a terrific bit of stuff to have done. It was, in fact, where on that tour that I met Toni Basil for the first time. She'd been working with a group of black dancers. This is 1974. Yeah.
Yes.
And in 1972, 73, she'd been working with a group of black dancers called the Lockers, who were, I guess, progenitors of what's now become the street dance.
We got it was Campbell Sinatra one time.
Oh, did you? You're aware of them? Yeah.
It really
was Tony who sort of brought them into the consciousness of at least of Californians. Yes. And I believe they did do the Johnny Carson show one time, very early on. But it's sad that Toni never got the recognition for doing that, because she worked so hard in the early 70s to make street dance something that people would know about. And it wasn't until the late 70s, it must have been the early 80s, until street dance itself became something.
Breakdancing.
And Toni was so much part of all that back in the 70s, and we were both aware, a little group of us, aware that that would be the way to go one day in dance, you know. And she choreographed that particular tour, and it had elements of that. I won't say that it was waving any great banner for street dance, but it had certainly had elements of what was to come.
When you were, you know, I read about your associations, you were so close, you were friendly with so many of the people on the cutting edge, the Mark Bolans, Brian Enos, and Lou Reed, and so forth. Did you have much of a relationship with the Zeppelin, Who, Beatles, Stones people?
Not really, other than Mick, who I met. Again, Mick is ambivalent in his likes and dislikes. He's actually quite conservative when it comes to making his own records, funnily enough. He's aware of new techniques all the time. He's aware of who's doing what and what's happening. But he has, being a roots man, which he is, I mean, still to this day, the music that he plays more than anything else is the blues. Rhythm and blues and the blues. He's never deviated from that. There's one thing you can say about Mick, is that he has absolute and perfect integrity to the music that he wanted to start playing when he first started playing music. And he's bemused by all the other things that go on. Whereas I'm more of a sucker, I'm more of a fan.
Yeah.
If it's wearing a pink hat and a red nose and it plays a guitar upside down, I'll go and look at it. You know, I love to see people being dangerous, you know. And Mick will be more of an onlooker, I think. That particular crowd, I guess Mick is the only one that I ever got to know. No, I never knew the Zeppelin or the Beatles, and John was the only one that I got to know, and that was, unfortunately... toward the end of his life. I first met him, again, it must have been 75-ish, Young Americans. About that, I think. I don't know, you've probably got better idea of the dates than I have. And that was truly an inspiration to be able to work with him, but it was one of those associations that lasted about the length of the recording.
Yeah.
And then we didn't see each other again for about a year. But then we started to pick up on what was becoming... a very instructive and quite deep relationship. I mean, he of course, again, another one who started off at art school, so a lot of the stuff that we used to talk about went into the world of the arts and why an artist wants to do things in the first place and all that. And it gets very sort of melodramatic and philosophic at 2 a.m. But it's
yeah, what you started
about. Yeah, but it's the kind of relationship that one savours, and it's something that you don't forget easily. I guess he was the only other one that I really got into close contact with. But I never really felt part of the other stuff, not from elitist things at all, is that I really didn't think I played as well as them and or sung. There was a real feeling of inadequacy in that area. I never really felt like a rock singer or rock star or whatever. And I always felt a little bit out of my element, which is a ridiculously highfalutin way of looking at it now from my standpoint when I look back and realised that from 72 through till about 76, I was the ultimate rock star. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have been more rock star.
Records and new,
but the lifestyle and everything. I mean, it's sort of, you know, anything that was going out there that had anything to do with it being a rock and roll singer, then I was, I'd say, hey, let's go for this, see what it's like. And I was it for all that period. But I never really, I kept myself away from them, or maybe they kept themselves away from me, I don't know.
With your own group, you term that, I knew Mark quite well because we released his records, the T-Rex records there.
Yeah.
He was delightful. I had a lot of fun with him.
Mark was great.
But you're, that only...
What a hustler.
He could get me turned around in a minute. I mean, about, let's go do this.
He was such a funny little guy. Yeah. He was such a mischievous elfin. Yeah. He really was. He knew exactly what he wanted. And he thought he knew how he was going to get it. And I tell you, man, I got this sound that you're just not going to believe, man. And then he'd go away and say, what the hell am I going to do? I've told everybody I've got this sound. And then he went, and you'd see him sort of working out things to support the statements he'd said. Yeah. And he was a great guy.
Did he impact your music at all?
The music, no, but just generally like a real London chummy thing. It was great. He was a great laugh. Yeah. And very... I tended to be, not so much these days, fortunately, but I would get depressed very easily. I found myself to be what they call a sensitive British type. The worst thing to be. And Mark was so buoyant that he could get, in 10 minutes, he could get you laughing about everything you thought was a real problem and a real trouble. No, he was a great, a good clown. Good clown, very talented guy as well.
Oh,
he knew what rock and roll was. He had
manipulate that audience.
He was a wonderful showman. He really was a great showman. And not enough good footage was ever taken of him, unfortunately. The stuff that I've seen is certainly second rate. There's no really, really... And I've seen him do some fantastic shows. One of those instances where nobody ever seemed to be there on the right night or something like that.
Did that group of people feel that they were an avant-garde? Did you, like a left-bank crowd?
Yeah. It had all that. Yeah. You know, there was a lot of feeling there. Well, I think that there was quite a logical reasoning for that, because there was a kind of a hardening of the arteries in rock up until that time. It really was looking for something new. And we felt that we had a certain amount of... we had a humorous and sartorial edge on things, I think, that we felt was missing in rock. And we knew that there had to be something new. And, hey, we're probably it.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd looked around and say, well, hey, there ain't much else. It's all so boring. Let's do... What do I want to see on a stage that would really make me excited? And I think we went about doing that.
The injection of another character in your life was, of course, the Freeze.
Mm.
How much did he have to do with creating, perpetrating, or destroying what you had going? Was he the perfect adjunct for you?
I'm never quite sure myself. I certainly, in terms of... quite nice of me to be able to have a way to say this publicly, but as far as creating what happened, I was 100% in terms of what happened creatively. Every single last touch of the mascara brush... was mine. There's absolutely no other way than that. In terms of getting me to an audience, or rather trying to get an audience in to see me, I don't know. DeFries certainly set up some extraordinary things, some of which I couldn't believe he was doing at the time, but I'm not sure. I really don't know if it hindered me or helped me. I have absolutely no idea. I just felt when the money was sort of going left, right, and center towards the end of our relationship that possibly this wasn't the best situation to be in anymore. But up until that time, like most first-time artists, you don't sort of look at the money and see what's happening.
But in terms of the career...
The career, I really don't know. I really don't know if it hindered or helped. I have absolutely no idea. One never does. It's probably good that it all happened in that way, because it was certainly interesting. I think the only thing I've seen that came anywhere close to that was the kind of the McLaren Sex Pistols operation.
Yes, yes.
Which again, I mean, and I'm probably being unfair on somebody, but from the outside, you don't exactly know who was the Sex Pistols. It's very odd. You get a reading that it was McLaren, you get other people say it was Johnny Rotten, you say it was a combination of the two. So I understand what sometimes it must look like from the outside in terms of me and main man and whatever. But Ziggy Stardust was me.
For anybody who ran into it, he was a terminal pain in the ass. You know, I mean, the guy just insisted on the box be facing this way and that be facing that way. And we would go to see you, we'd wonder why they had to put the box that way. You
know? I think his entire philosophy behind all that, which we all felt, all of us that were involved with him, was absolutely almost Dadaist, that if you go out and say you're a star, then if you go and say it loudly and long enough, people will say it back.
It becomes reality.
No. And I know that his ultimate idol was Colonel
Parker.
Was the Colonel, yeah. Colonel Parker, I think, played a great part in his dreams, an enormous part in his dreams. And it became, I guess, that sort of that metaphysical relationship that he had with Parker became kind of a joke around the office. I mean, we all felt it was maybe we wondered which of us was the rock star at sometimes, you know. Whoa! But it was glorious. It was gloriously funny. I guess now, I think it's funny.
Do you have an affection for some of these characters that you've created as as you look back?
I think the only time I get sort of, kind of nostalgic about any of that stuff at all is if I see the odd video or something, or I see a bit of the Ziggy Stardust concerts or whatever. No, other than that, I don't think I'm cold about them, but I think it's work done. And I do tend to move on. I don't incorporate much hindsight artistically into what I'm doing.
I think that's an actor's attitude, too.
I think you have to, otherwise you start... you get into a danger of getting into the rut and maybe try to perpetuate something that's gone before. Again, for either to bolster your own feelings of confidence or to keep that audience, which seems to be the bane of a lot of performers. A lot of people that I know are bugged with the idea that they've got to have an audience, they've got to be liked, or they've got, And I think the more that you fall into that trap, it makes your own life harder to come to terms with, because an audience appreciation is only going to be periodic at the best of times. You'll fall in and out of favour continually. It's not... I don't think it should be something one should be looking for. I think you should turn around at the end of the day and say, I really like that piece of work, or that piece of work sucked. Not, was that popular or wasn't it popular? I don't think that's... I think it's the job of the record companies and a lot of other people around the artist to possibly weigh up those situations. But I think the artist himself does owe it to himself and ultimately to whatever audience he's going to have to give the best of what he can do and feels personally satisfied with.
Have you set yourself up to be measured by a different standard that you just can't go out and make a record and do a tour, that you have to be someone? That, is there pressure on you to do that?
To do a tour?
To be someone, not to make the 14th David Bowie record, but now you've got to be the Glass Spider.
Yeah.
You've got to...
Yeah. I'm not sure. I think I might have helped myself in that way, saving myself being entrapped by that with the Sirius Moonlight tour. It helped an awful lot to just go out without a character and just do it on the strength of a body of work. However, I had done that before. 1976 was the last time I did a character performance, which was the Thin White Duke.
Yes.
After that, I toured again in 78. I think it's probably the least known of any of the tours that I've done, but that was the first time I had sort of stripped away anything that had to do with character, and just went out and performed a body of work. And I felt so happy doing that, and almost a sense of relief in a way, that I could actually go out and sing my own songs without having to
be somebody else, rather.
Yes,
how do you look at your body of work? Is there a great deal of pride? Is there
an awful lot of pride.
Any period in particular that...
Yes, I guess, well, the further away I get from it, the more I like the Ziggy Stardust. And I had a period where I just couldn't face it anymore. I mean, it's around the early 80s. I mean, I really thought, God, it's the bane of my existence, that stuff. Like, you know, it really sort of chases me around everywhere. But one has to, I guess, expect that. Yeah. But I used to make a point of, in the 78 tour, do as few of those songs as possible and all that. And I really quite like some of that period now. I like some of the Diamond Dog stuff. But I guess, for me, the period that I had with Brian Eno were about 3 years, consecutive years. We were recording together and working together. And I produced three albums, Low Heroes and Lodger, the three of which I feel were some of the most exciting bits of work that I've ever done, in terms of approaching a rapidly approaching new way of making records and working with computers and I guess the first sort of paddling around with techno pop. It was really something new to both of us. I mean, the idea of working with what was really happening in Germany, it was the antithesis of what was happening in England, where rock had gone back to its most almost primeval form with the punk revolution, a lot of which I admire very much indeed, as a movement, not individual pieces of work, because I don't think in a movement like that it's the individual pieces that are of the import. It's what the celebration was about, and in that time it was a celebration of, hey, I can do this, any sucker can do this, and that I thought was great. I thought that was terrific. However, where I was living at the time, which was in Berlin, with my girlfriend at that time, and Iggy and his girlfriend were set up there as well, and then Brian Eno came over and joined us, we would get so excited about a whole new thing that was happening in Dusseldorf, and this Connie Plank studio sound, which was all about computers and synthesizers and this almost mechanical approach to rock, which that same period, I think, produced. We all got over the moon about Giorgio Moroder and Donna Summers. The first single that they put out, we said, that's rock over the next 10 years. And it really was. He must have done it, I think. Sure. I think he really did the first one that really said that this is what rock was going to sound like over the next 10 years at least. And it's still as true today as it was then.
You were incredibly prolific during a period of time here, over a two-year period, maybe five albums or six albums.
Yes, yeah, that really took its toll, I think. Yeah. It's hard. Well, I don't know, I think every artist probably has that one period where you just cannot stop working. I think you're very lucky if it happens to you again. I think it's a pleasure if it does happen again. I don't think any artist can expect it to happen again. And that for me was obviously a very exciting time.
Have the motion pictures been a distraction to the music? Do you find that to your career?
No, it's almost like taking a sabbatical or something. It's great to be able to put one sort of creative area in the hands of somebody else and see just out of the interest what they do with it. It's kind of a luxurious position to be in, really, where people will ask for me to work with them, and I don't have to do it for the money. I can really just do it because I want to do it. It's a possibility I might be doing a lot more theatre things over the next couple of years, because I really don't want to leave that behind and get immersed too much in something that becomes so secular as this kind of, you know, the rock thing, because it can grate one, it can really wear one down to be totally in one area of the arts.
What about the relationship with Iggy Pop? Where did this stem from? And
I think probably the reason that we get on so well is that we are the antithesis of each other. Ostensibly it seems that way, but when at a roots level we're not at all. We all read the same books. We both sort of, I think, gravitate towards the same kinds of bands and music. And maybe I'm a little more into a wider spectrum of the arts than Jim, but that certainly doesn't stop Jim from enjoying them a lot. But he has a far more animal approach to what he does, and there's a lot more physicality in what Jim does. Well, I guess a lot of what I do starts off from a more cerebral thing. Maybe it displays itself more physically by the time it hits the stage. But we both work in very different ways. I guess that's why we enjoy each other's companies, that we are so different.
Do you have just some impression of those 12, 14 years in there? I mean, do you look back, do you think it's almost happened to somebody else?
Yeah, some of it. It definitely did happen to somebody else. Boy. But I think, gosh. On the whole, I think it's quite kaleidoscopic. It's been quite a rich, colourful affair over the last 12, 14. It's probably, I think we can push it back even further than
probably,
that, 15 years.
Yeah,
60s. Yes. And I think I probably would not have given up any one part of that. I think it's all been rather terrific. I feel very lucky to have been able to do all that stuff.
And still come through it and be regarded seriously as an artist?
Some would say seriously, some not.
Is it hard being David Bowie?
Not really, not now, no. I don't have the outsider's problem. I mean, for me, the world that I inhabit in reality is a probably a very different world from the one that people would expect that I would be in. It's far removed from a lot of what they would feel would be the limousine trappings of a rock existence or whatever. It's quite sedate. It's constantly moving. I travel an awful lot, which is one of the glories of being able to be in the particular business that we're in.
Well, thank you.
I don't know if you remember that one.
I remember.
It must have been around 69, 70, one of my first trips
to
America.
You were in the States then,
huh? Oh, yeah. And it was absolutely, I mean, I'd adored his work ever since I was, because I was into jazz quite heavily when I was a kid, and I liked the usuals, Eric Dolphy, you know, yes, Coltrane, sir. Parker, and all that. Because I played saxophone originally when I was messing around with. I was either going to be the greatest painter on earth or the worst saxophonist. I became the worst saxophonist.
I talked to Sting a couple of weeks ago, and he's talking about Gil Evans, what a jazz fan Sting was.
It was big with the British rock players in the beginning. Yeah. I think jazz had an awful lot to do with it. And I saw Kenton at this club and there must have been more people on stage than there were in the audience. It was the saddest of events because of that.
It was over.
He didn't look well. But the music was just wonderful still. It was just sonic to sit there and hear this stuff that I'd only heard on albums. And there were maybe 15 of us in the audience, you know, and we'd be all of it, nearly in tears at the end of the night when these like 20 guys stood up and we 15 guys.
Pete Rugolo did a lot of
arrangements,
and Connie Condoli, and those people are still around Hollywood.
Yeah.
And in fact, I got Pete Rugolo, who's working on this compilation. He's finding the masters, we're remixing them and remastering them digitally and so forth. Because I was a college disc jockey when he started.
Yeah.
And I would play Kent. Yeah. It blew my mind.
It was so new.
Whoa, I mean, through the earphones. Yeah. I turned that thing up loud.
Yeah.
I've never heard anything like that.
Just fantastic. Yeah.
Well, there's a few I've missed. I had an appointment with Benny Goodman and he died 3 days before, which was more inconvenient for him than for me, of course. But And a few have died since. Buddy Rich interviewed, and Woody Herman. They both have passed on.
Yeah.
But I've got them on tape. These tapes are going to four colleges that have asked, from Yale and University of Southern California, Michigan, for their archives.
Great.
And it's a worthwhile book, you know. And for me, if it doesn't sell a copy, what an experience, you know, to be talking to the people.
Call it Artistry and Rhythm.
Artistry and Rhythm. I'll do that.